This is Christina Borgeson with the Whistleblower Newsroom. Celia Farber's with me today, too. Celia, our guest today is Chris Bolin, arguably the top third rail investigative researcher reporter on the most third rail subject probably in the world. What is his subject? Who committed the crime of 9/11? So he's been on quite a journey since high school, actually, after which he traveled through the Middle East and Europe. He went to the University of California at Davis Santa Cruz and earned a degree in history with a focus on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, another third rail issue. After the first Gulf War, he led an international team of photojournalists on a trip through the West Bank and Gaza. He's written in-depth articles about the Middle East, electronic vote fraud, and the dangers of depleted uranium, another big issue. But he is, perhaps, best known for his in-depth research into the history, geopolitical background, and forensic evidence connected to the terror attacks on 9/11. He's spoken all around the U.S. and Europe about his work. One of his key books is Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, in which he approached 9/11 as a crime to be solved. Welcome, Chris. I'm welcoming you.
Yes, hello.
Oh, there you are. Yes. There you are. Oh. Yes. Have you been listening to us blathering on?
I've heard you.
Okay.
You found the volume button, huh? Okay.
Okay.
So, welcome, Chris. Such an honor.
Thank you. Welcome. Nice to be with you.
So, listen, just let's dive right in. The first thing I want to do is have you talk about the forensic evidence before we get into the circumstances or the context.
Right.
Could you do that, please? The hard evidence that it didn't go down the way the formal narrative or the official narrative is.
Sure. Sure. Well, to make it simple for people, I present the case of the molten metal, the molten iron that was seen pouring off of the building South Tower from the 81st floor about 7 minutes before the towers collapsed. And the thing is that there's this molten iron found in all aspects of 9/11. It's found in the dust that rolled through Manhattan when the towers came down contained a huge number of these tiny iron spheres, tiny droplets of iron with some aluminum in them. And these are microspheres, and they're very, very, very small. So you see them under a microscope. And other metals were also reduced to these tiny droplets, which meant that extremely high temperatures were reached before, during, and after the collapse. These temperatures cannot possibly be reached with burning jet fuel or office fires. It's just not possible.
Yes, because burning jet fuel doesn't reach.
This is something like thermite. Go ahead.
Yeah, burning jet fuel does not reach those temperatures. I mean, I know from my investigation of TWA Flight 800, but yes. Okay,
right.
Go ahead.
And that's evidence that something other than jet fuel brought down the towers. And because it cannot be explained by the official narrative, the investigating authorities, so-called investigations that were done by NIST and others, ignored. They simply ignored the existence of this molten iron.
Well, how did they explain the buildings basically collapsing in their own footprints?
Well, they really didn't. What these various reports did was they were constrained by time and what their scope was, and they basically said they explained what was going on in the building up until the point of collapse, and then they said at that point collapse was inevitable, and it fell down. So they don't really go into how the buildings fell. And they talk about...
So it's sin of omission reporting in the NIST report,
yes,
is that?
Yes, but the basic thesis that they present is that it's a fire-induced gravity collapse. And that's simply not possible. You can't have a fire-induced gravity collapse that's symmetrical and also falls at the rate of free fall.
Why not?
Well, because the towers were built with extremely redundant steel structures, and they had 47 central columns, box columns, that were embedded in the bedrock of Manhattan, about seven stories below the surface of the street. And for the buildings to have fallen symmetrically down, all 47 of those central columns, which were weight-bearing columns, would have to fail at the exact same time. Otherwise, the building would have fallen to the left or to the right, one way or the other. So that means that all those huge box columns had to be severed simultaneously. In all three cases, in all three towers, Tower 1, Tower 2, and Tower 7.
May I ask a possibly stupid question, Cecilia?
Sure.
Not being being a prepared mind for everything we're talking about here, but not a real student of it.
That's fine, right?
I have other subjects I've gotten into. Why was it important for those who committed this crime that the buildings be gone?
Well, that's a very good question. They needed to be, I think, totally destroyed in order for the spectacle to be to have the psychological power that it had on the public. It had to be complete devastation. You see, there was a similar tower, well, not nearly as well built as them, but there was a tower called the Windsor Tower a year or so later in Spain, in Madrid.
Yep.
And it had a terrible fire. It burned for like 24 hours like a torch. It just burned like a torch. And it didn't fall. The central columns held up the building, and just the first couple floors had some collapsing around the edges.
Yeah.
And so this shows that when these buildings are subjected to such temperatures and burning jet fuel, they're not going to collapse. So in order to make the psychological impact of this terror spectacle, successful, they had to completely pulverize and destroy. And also, in order to destroy the evidence as much as possible, you see, that's part of the thing, is that these towers were destroyed, and the destruction was so total that even the evidence of what caused the towers to be destroyed was thought to be destroyed.
Okay.
The discovery of this super thermite, this nano thermite that was found years later by Professor Stephen Jones and a team of scientists, that was a discovery that was not supposed to happen, you see? And the collapse of the towers was not supposed to be explained. But when they discovered little tiny fragments of this super thermite, which made using nanotechnology, then the cat was out of the bag. And they had to come out with all kinds of spurious red herring explanations, because that was a discovery that was not supposed to happen.
And that's very important. Could you just detail a little bit more? How again did that discovery happen?
Yeah, well, there was indications that something like that was had happened, because already back in 2001, 2002, molten steel was found when they got down to the bedrock of Manhattan. So when they got down through all those basement levels to the seventh basement level, and they got down to the bedrock, they found molten iron in the molten state. And this was 3, 4, 5 weeks after the demolition of the towers. And this stuff was still molten.
Wow.
So it was still very, very hot.
Mm-hmm.
And this was found in the basements of all three towers, North Tower, South Tower, and Larry Silverstein's building number 7, 47-story building that collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon. So this indicated something quite unusual. An unusual energy source had been involved in the destruction of the buildings. And so we knew that there was evidence of thermite, there was evidence of melted steel beams, there was evidence even of vaporized steel. That's steel beams that got so hot in certain points that the steel of the beam evaporated into thin air. And then that kind of stuff would, of course, condense later and become little droplets. But in any case, so a guy named Stephen Jones, who was a professor of chemistry and physics at Brigham Young University in Utah, he was perplexed by the collapse of Building 7, which no plane had struck, why that building had fallen. So he began looking at it, And I was working with him, you know, indirectly, and I went out and visited him in Utah, and he wanted to get samples of the dust from the World Trade Center, which was not easy to do, especially since I was on the West Coast. But I went out to Davis, California, and there I found this survey of the dust that had been done by the U.S. Geological Survey, which showed these tiny balls of iron and molybdenum, other metals that were found in the dust. And he eventually got six samples of dust from people in New York City who sent him the dust that they had collected from their apartments or from their cars, what have you. And in these samples of dust, they found these little tiny fragments of an orange, silver, looked like paint, a bilayered paint. But when they took these little chips and heated them up to 400 degrees, 420 degrees Celsius, they detonated, they exploded, and created a lot of energy, a lot of heat, and a tiny little ball of iron. That's thermite. That's super thermite. That's done. It's made using nanotechnology. That's reducing the particles to the nano size, which is extremely small.
So that's why, first of all, that's why also the cement or the concrete was vaporized as well, right, in the buildings.
Well, the concrete, we saw that there were extremely powerful explosions. And the towers were basically demolished from the top down. And then we had these huge clouds of dust and concrete and drywall and everything that was in the building being thrust into these huge pyroclastic clouds. And these are the clouds that rolled through Manhattan. This was the utter pulverization of the towers. Each floor was about an acre of concrete. So that's all of that concrete was basically turned into dust. And that dust was a fine dust that coated Manhattan like a snowstorm. And it was in that dust that they found it was very hot. When people felt this dust, they saw fire and they felt fire. They were burned by it.
Wow.
So the dust was extremely hot. And that's because the energy of that nanothermite was in the clouds. But all of the concrete and all the contents of the building were pulverized.
I thought there were explosions in the basement as well.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you know, William Rodriguez, for example, the janitor in building North Tower, he was in the basement, second floor sub-basement, and he witnessed explosions before the plane hit the building. So this is North Tower, basement level, sub-basements, a plane just a few seconds before the plane struck the building. There was a mighty explosion that did extreme damage in the basement level. And that's normal with any sort of demolition of huge high-rise towers. You have to take out the basement first.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. So I was listening to a talk that you were giving, and you were saying that to get away with a crime like this, that you had to control the investigation, control access to the evidence, control the interpretation of the event, and control litigation.
That's right.
So it's very interesting that we had a lawyer, one of the 9/11 lawyers on here, who, you know, they submitted to the Southern District Court a petition to look at the government's complicity in suppressing mm-hmm. the forensic evidence. And I did mention that I was a little skeptical that you know, a grand jury, the whole grand jury process on that would lead to anything. But, you know, I may be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong. But I guess what I want to ask you is, so that part is being acknowledged, you know, by a court finally, that the forensic evidence needs to, and the government's participation. Now, you have done a lot of research on who did what.
Mm-hmm.
So could you run us through that?
Sure. Well, in the very beginning, you know, I happened to be going through New York City on September 11th in the morning, and so, you know, the story fell into my lap. I couldn't go to Washington because of the attack at the Pentagon. So I began writing about it, and it fit exactly in the kinds of things that I had been working on for years prior to that: the government cover-ups, Flight 800, other cover-ups. And right away, I could see that there was a cover-up going on from the very beginning, in that very important aspects of the catastrophe were not being discussed, or if they were discussed, they were discussed once and never again.
Like what?
And explosions was main thing.
Okay.
The evidence of explosions at the prior to and during and after the collapse of the World Trade Center, this was ignored. You know, like the firefighters, there were like 160 firefighters who saw or felt explosions, people who were right there who know exactly what an explosion looks like and feels like, and yet these people were being ignored by the mainstream media. They were being reported maybe in People magazine, for example. That's one magazine that didn't seem to get the memo, and they had published a piece by three people who had been inside the towers. One was a firefighter who witnessed explosions. But when you see this kind of subject being deleted, censored from the narrative, you know that something's up. And there were other aspects that were being covered up as well. So then we were, of course, given this fabricated version, this version that this was done by Osama bin Laden and 19 Arabs, whose passports were found in pristine condition in some cases, and who left incriminating evidence
behind. Yeah, that was
bizarre.
In all that mess, they found Mohammed Atta's passport, was it? That was so bizarre to me.
Yeah, they found one guy's passport that was like completely intact, not even burned, who was one of the guys on one of these planes. So you could see that something was going on. But we were given this narrative that was presented without any evidence, and was designed to take us to war, which was meant to kick off the war on terror. And that's what it did. And so ever since, you know, October of 2001, we've been involved in this costly and fruitless war on terror, which is now the longest and most expensive war in U.S. history. But I realized then that the government was not involved in investigating the crime, but rather they were involved in covering up the crime. Because the evidence from the crime scene was being carted away from the very beginning, 24/7.
As fast as possible, yeah.
Yes, yes. Steel was being taken to two junkyards in Jersey, mm-hmm. cut up into small pieces, mixed with other scrap, and sent to Asia where it was being melted down. Wow. So, very clearly this was a cover-up at the highest level. And that's why I call my book Solving 9/11, because I realized that the government and the media were not interested in solving the crime. This was, as I often say, this is a crime that was not meant to be solved. The entire crime was not meant to be solved. It was, it was given to us. We saw it. We experienced it, and then we were given a interpretation, and the interpretation was given to us by the Israelis, the Israeli chief of staff, a man named Ehud Barak, former prime minister.
You know, Ehud is interesting because he was he's also popped up in. In the Epstein case. So Ehud here, there, and everywhere.
Yes, yeah. And he's not the only guy from 9/11 who pops up in the Epstein case.
Interesting.
The important connection there with Epstein is this mega group that he's tied up into, these very powerful Jewish billionaires like Spielberg and Ronald Lauder from the Lauder family.
What is the mega group's mission?
The Bronfmans. Well, mega is basically very wealthy Jewish billionaires who are very strongly Zionist, who came together as a group in 1991 when Yitzhak Shamir, the notorious terrorist, was the prime minister of Israel, had been Israel's prime minister for already 5-6 years prior to. But in 1991, that was a very big year. That was the year Robert Maxwell was killed or died off the coast of Spain. That was the year that George Herbert Walker Bush did not want to give the $10 billion loan guarantee to Israel. That was the year after the first Gulf War and the Madrid Conference, where they tried to push Israel into a peace deal with the Palestinians in some way.
Right.
And Shamir's response was to create this mega group of very powerful, well-connected Jewish billionaires who would help Israel, like Sayanim helpers at the highest level in the United States. And Ronald Lauder, as I said, is part of this group.
Son, right?
And Estee Lauder's son, that's correct. And this is the guy who privatized the World Trade Center. He privatized the World Trade Center towers in July of 2001. They were finally
privatized. Just in time for September 11th.
Right. They were turned over to a guy named Larry Silverstein and at the end of July. And the rest is history.
Okay, but who in the U.S. government, I mean, if mm-hmm. here... If this is an act of terror, and you're the United States government, you're part of the intelligence, global intelligence services, CIA, FBI, whatever, if you were going to extraordinarily render the terrorists, who would you extraordinarily render, and what would you ask them?
Now, if I had been in that position, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I would have, you know, examined, worked from the evidence, and found those people who were involved in the crime and the cover-up.
Well, who? And who are they?
Well, the first person you find in the cover-up is the person who was supposed to investigate the crime and prosecute the crime, and that was a guy named Michael Chertoff.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the assistant attorney general in charge of the Department of Crime. Criminal division of the DO, Department of Justice. And he was the person who was supposed to, serving under John Ashcroft, he was the one who was given the 9/11 portfolio. That was his job to prosecute that. Now, what happened here was that on day one, again, George Herbert Walker Bush, probably at the behest of Ari Fleischer, declared that the attacks of 9/11 were an act of war. And that's a technical legal term, because when you call it an act of war, you're saying that we were attacked by a foreign nation and we're going to respond with war.
Yeah, but why would Ari Fleischer honestly be the one to do it? I mean, he's just the spokesperson. Somebody else must have told.
Yeah, but Ari Fleischer was the press secretary.
Yeah, I know.
He was in charge. He was in charge of communications for the president, and so he's the one who crafted the response that the president expressed on 9/11 in the evening when he spoke at the White House. Now, so how did President Bush know to say what he said? There had been no investigation. How did he know that this was being done by Osama bin Laden and from Afghanistan and what have you? How did he know this? Well, I submit that this came from the connection of Ari Fleischer. Ari Fleischer is the person whose job it was to craft his response. Ari Fleischer's brother worked with an Israeli company in New Jersey, which was connected to Ehud Barak again. So simply by picking up the phone, Ari Fleischer would speak to his brother, who was in this network with Ehud Barak.
Well, wasn't Barak the first person to actually go to the media and say, oh, this was done by bin Laden?
Yes, in London. It just happened that Ehud Barak was in London, and in the studio of the BBC World Television, which is the largest English-speaking television network in the world, and he gave his interpretation of what we had just experienced before the towers had even finished falling. You know, the day was still young in New York when he gave this interpretation to the world media. Then he went over on the same side of town to Sky News, which is Murdoch's company, and did the same thing again and blamed Osama bin Laden. And so this was the Zionist narrative. This was the prepared narrative that was given to the public, the world public, as soon as possible.
But what about our president and our vice president? I mean, you say this as if the Zionists are in control of the U.S. government. I mean, come on. What about the U.S. members of the U.S. government? I mean, what about – okay, so Chertoff.
Yeah, I'm trying to explain that. You see, okay. It's like these people that are in the U.S. government, like Michael Chertoff. Michael Chertoff is a son of the Mossad. He's an Israeli national. He's an Israeli citizen.
He's got to be a dual citizen if he's working.
Dual citizen. Because his mother is an Israeli national, so he's an Israeli. And he was the person in charge of investigating the crime. Beneath him, serving him, was the FBI. The FBI had a brand new director, Robert Mueller, and it was Mueller's job to find the evidence, present the evidence to Mr. Chertoff, and then Chertoff would then prosecute the crimes of terrorism. But as I said, because they changed it from being a crime, they called it an act of war, they precluded the need for
a criminal investigation.
Right. So that's, people have to understand that there has not been an investigation of 9/11. There never was an investigation of 9/11. Instead of a proper criminal investigation, what we got were these prepared papers, these reports from people like FEMA, American Society of Civil Engineers, and NIST, which were basically meant to simply support the official story.
The official narrative.
Now, you talk about other people in the government. You look at, say, for example, the CIA. The CIA at that time was run by a guy named What's his name? Buzzy Krongard.
Krongard.
That's a kind of a fake name. Krongard. Yeah. It's a fake name. It's his real name was, I think the family name was from Poland someplace. And he's a Jewish guy. And he was the executive director of the CIA. Not only that, he had previously been the CEO of a company called Alex Brown, an investment bank in Baltimore. And the Alex Brown Bank was actually the bank that had negotiated all of these put options that were made on the airlines and other companies that tanked on 9/11. So this man was the executive director of the CIA when 9/11 happened.
Yeah, his name is Alvin Bernard Krongard.
Yeah. And I spoke to him. I sent him my set of books, and his wife. His wife happens to be the CEO of Rothschild North America. But the point is that when you talk about an inside job is a little bit of a misnomer because it gives the impression that American officials inside the U.S. government were responsible for 9/11. That's a little bit of a stretch. It's not Americans. It's a group of people whose primary loyalty is to the state of Israel. People like Buzzy Krongard, people like Michael Chertoff. And a host of others, you know, like the guy that owned the Three Towers that day, Larry Silverstein. He was a very big Zionist in New York City. It goes on and on and on. So these are the people who, although on the outside they appear to be American, they are American. Their political loyalty, their devotion is to the state of Israel.
They're like Trojan horses in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you been accused of? Fairly often of being a conspiracy theorist and an anti-Semite by any chance?
I don't get accused of being a conspiracy theorist that much. I don't hear that very much. But anti-Semite is something that I've been called, frequently by people who are part of the problem. When I spoke in New York in Brooklyn a couple years ago, there was a mob there outside the cafe where I was speaking. And they came in, they caused a big ruckus and everything like that, and the police had to come and, you know, separate the sides and everything and help me out when I left. But this was a group that was there, a group from Racial and Economic Equality, something organization for that. But the group that was leading the protest was headed by a guy from Uzbekistan, an immigrant from Uzbekistan, a Jewish guy. But the group was funded by Larry and Clara Silverstein.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, okay, well, Larry and Clara Silverstein are the recipients of something like $5 billion from the damage that was, the 9/11 destruction of the Twin Towers, which Larry had just received in July of 2001.
How did you know how did you find out that group was funded by them?
Well, I mean, I had to find out who this group was because whenever there's a protest outside one of my events in America, it's always organized. It's organized by a local chapter of some organization,
right?
And you know, these people had written about it and they talked about it, and I looked them up, and right there on their front webpage it says who they're funded by, and
oh, wow.
Larry and Clara Silverstein were at the top of the list.
Wow so
it's like consider the source when you're same thing is like in the very beginning in October of 2001, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, criticized my article about eyewitness evidence of explosions in the World Trade Center. They criticized it as being grist for the anti-Semitic mill of American Free Press.
Yeah, but did they address any of the facts in what you were saying, or did they just call you a name?
No, of course not. Of course.
Yeah, and they didn't even say what in the article was in any way anti-Semitic or anything in the paper that was anti-Semitic, because nothing was. The paper had been very, very careful since it had been.
Did you ask them?
I don't know if I may. I don't know if I asked them. I don't think I responded to them. But it was one of these memos they put out.
Unbelievable.
These things that they put out, and it was like, it was very telling because for them to be protesting an article about eyewitness evidence of explosions at the World Trade Center is very revealing. It's like, you know, they say the woman protesteth too much. You're showing by protesting something that's really not worthy of being protesting. you're showing you're trying to cover up, you're trying to suppress evidence, you're trying to distort the discourse.
You said that the FBI destroyed the evidence. Is that true? And if that's true, how do you know, and who in the FBI was in charge of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the FBI was in charge of the entire investigation, as it were, at the Ground Zero in New York, for example. And we know that from the very beginning, trucks were being loaded with steel from the top floors, from the very top of the pile was being loaded and taken by barge to these two junkyards in Jersey, and was being cut up in pieces and sent to Asia. That's destruction.
Did the FBI do that, though? I mean, how do you know that?
Yeah, well, they're in charge. They are in charge of the criminal investigation, which means that they're in charge of preservation of evidence.
Right. May I ask why Asia?
It's a crime scene.
Why Asia?
Why Asia? Good question. You have to read my book, Solving 9/11, The Deception Changed the World, in the last chapters about the destruction of the evidence to get all the details. But basically, there were two junkyards, metal management of and the other one was the Napurano's junkyard in Jersey. Both junkyards had been taken over in the few months prior to 9/11 and were under the control of Zionist entities. One was taken over by Oppenheimer, CIBC, this is the Canadian International Imperial Bank of Canada, whatever, Oppenheimer. They took over control of one, and the other one was taken over by another, some other guys, Zionist guys. And they control, and this was all being done, this network was being established prior to 9/11, whereby the steel from the World Trade Center was being sold to recipients in Asia through a network of a couple former diamond dealers from Antwerp, from Belgium, who had worked with Mark Rich. And they established this trading network, and they were trading. They were taking the steel from the World Trade Center, shipping it, cutting up in pieces, and shipping it to Asia at a time, a historic time, when the price of scrap steel was the lowest it had been in 50 years. That makes no sense, because they were paying $25 a ton to ship the steel to China or to Asia,
wow,
India, what have you. So why were they doing that? Because by shipping it to Asia, they were getting it far, far away from prying eyes in New Jersey and New York, and they were destroying it. They were destroying the steel. And this was a big, big protest. The guys from Fire Engineering Magazine protested about it at the end of the year. Nobody could seem to understand how this was happening, how and why this was happening. Well, they weren't looking for answers. They were simply like, you know, lamenting.
You
that
know,
all the evidence is being stolen and destroyed.
It's so interesting because, you know, prior to 9/11, there was the first destruction of the World Trade Tower. There was the first bombing in the World Trade Center. And I remember being on a radio show. I was co-hosting a radio show with DEA agent Mike Levine. And we were talking about that, the bombing, and he had this this recording of Imad Salem. Imad Salem was an FBI asset who was put among the bomb makers to document what they were doing and create a sting. And literally a few months or before the bombing, Imad Salem's handlers called him up and said, "We're pulling you out." And Imad, he was so shocked that he actually recorded this phone conversation between him and his FBI handler. And he was going, "What are you doing? They're about to do this, and you're pulling me out now." And the guy was talking about, "Well, we don't have the budget anymore." And he was like making bubkas, you know, per week.
Yep.
And he was going, "What? This is very dangerous. This is, and he was like, he was frantic. But they obviously pulled him out and let this thing happen. Okay,
right.
And then they brought Imad back and paid him $1 million to finger the guys in court.
Exactly.
So this precursor, this sort of telegraph bombing is what it looks like to me.
And you know who the attorney for the District of New Jersey was in the prosecution of that case?
Who?
It was Michael Chertoff. Michael Chertoff.
Oh, my God. These names just keep popping up all over.
Yes. Michael Chertoff was the prosecutor in that case who provided the information, because this group you're talking about was based in New Jersey, I think in Elizabeth, where Chertoff happens to be from.
And then, you know, later after all this 9/11 stuff, Chertoff became head of Homeland Security, didn't he?
That's right. A couple years later. But what he did first was he sequestered all the important evidence. You know, they confiscated evidence, sequestered it, made it secret. Videotapes from the Pentagon. They destroyed the steel. The engine, the jet engine parts, the pieces of aircraft that were discovered in the aftermath, these parts were never properly identified because, you know, crucial air parts parts of an airplane are identified with identification numbers.
Right.
And they are time tracked. That means they're put on a plane at a certain time. They're tracked. They're written down when they're changed, when they're exchanged, when they're damaged, what have you. None of that was done. So, like I said, it was not an investigation of 9/11 in any meaningful way. And it was not a criminal investigation. It was a cover-up.
I have to tell you, the Pentagon and the Pennsylvania sites were just downright bizarre. I mean, that Pentagon, that video, I mean, the videos from the surrounding hotels, the video from that station that was, like, very bizarre. You couldn't see anything. And then that video, oh, yeah, here's the plane going in. And the video that they give you when they have the Pentagon is surrounded by video cameras, something way off in the distance, and you see this little flicker of light, and that's it that they presented to the public. And and even that, they had taken a few frames out of it. And, you know, Shanksville, no bodies, no nothing, just a hole. Mm-hmm. And could you talk about what you found out about that? The one, the site that they were saying was the site actually wasn't.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that in Shanksville, Pennsylvania there, you know, what the public was shown was a hole in the ground in this reclaimed mine. And we were told that that's where the plane had crashed. But what appears to have happened there was that a small combat aircraft, like an A-10 Warthog, had flown over some trees. When it got over the mine, it shot an air-to-ground missile and made this little hole in the ground. And that was told. We were told that's where the plane crashed. But there, as you said, there was no evidence of any plane going into the ground. The hole was only 20 feet across. There was no indication of any part of an aircraft being there, whereas further in the woods, about a quarter mile in the woods, there was found lots and lots of debris, and that was where the FBI was involved in recovering the debris, and it was around the homes, the cabins of the Hoover family. And, you know...
Plane? Was it the actual plane?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
nobody knows because nobody.
We weren't even told. We weren't even told that was.
Everybody
crash
was taken
site.
to the fake site.
Okay, but there was some kind of airplane debris in the woods. We're not sure about that.
Yeah, well, the thing is, there's a video taken by a Pittsburgh news helicopter in the very beginning, and it's flying over the woods, and it's got its camera on the ground. It's not the sharpest video that they could have gotten, but it shows lots and lots of small pieces of whatever it was. It was a very strong explosion, and evidence of this evidence from the plane was found in a very large area, many miles. So what indicates that there was some sort of like explosion or breakup of the aircraft at a high elevation. And the indications are that the plane was shot down.
You said it was it landed in the woods on the property of a guy named Reverend Hoover, and Hoover said that he didn't say anything because he was just trying to cooperate.
Yeah,
Where is this Hoover character? I mean, does he? What does he think about all that?
Well, I spoke to him. He was a reverend, a Lutheran minister, I think, and I think I also spoke to his son Barry Hoover. Because they had several cabins, and a lot of the evidence was right around Barry Hoover's, around his cabin. Whatever explosion happened was so powerful it turned his garage door like upside down and backwards.
Wow.
It flipped his, you know, so it was a very strong concussion, and there's something happened there. But what we know is that the FBI completely, first of all, they made the site secret, so that we were misled thinking that the site was here, but it was actually there. So that they kept that debris operation, that removal of the debris, secret. And all of the human remains that were found in that area were taken and sent to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where the identification was being done, again, by the FBI. And body parts that could not be identified were being cremated and put in a landfill. So, what they found there, this is the kind of thing that it would take a very high level lawsuit against the FBI to find out the names of the investigators, the FBI people who were involved in this, and what the evidence that they retrieved was and where it went.
You know,
we're dealing with a law enforcement agency that has become unlawful,
out of control. Well, you know, I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm remembering, you know, our investigation, our whistleblower investigation. I don't know if you saw my film. We had six whistleblowers plus this very astute physicist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the FBI was front and center containing the evidence, suppressing the evidence, and then, you know, and also getting rid of it, you know. And
that's right.
And lying about it to the public, and bringing in the CIA to give a bogus, you know, here's what the eyewitnesses saw. You know, they didn't see what they thought they saw. I mean, so the FBI was in charge of controlling that evidence. You're saying the FBI was in charge of controlling the 9/11 evidence, and they certainly, I mean, what they did for the first bombing, I mean, that was recorded. that was recorded by Imad Salem. Mm-hmm. And now, guess they're in charge of the, I know this seems like apropos of nothing, but they're in charge of gathering the evidence for the Epstein stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a RICO case against the FBI, if you ask me. But the question is, how do you break through?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, It's the Department of Justice. You know, the FBI is an agency of the Department of Justice. So there's obviously, very deeply entrenched corruption in the Department of Justice. And that's what has to, you know, that's the problem right there. Because all of these crimes, like the Epstein case, you know, I was just reading the other day that they haven't even gone to his ranch in New Mexico.
Well, you know, I actually think they've been in very recent days. I think they've gotten there finally.
Yeah, but the thing is that the way that Jeffrey Epstein died or was killed in that jail, that's all very suspicious. I mean, that's like a complete failure of the Department of Justice to protect their prisoner, and these are the cases that do not get investigated, do not get solved, and you know. Epstein is a very important case because it's like the mechanism by which they control the government. They have all the blackmail material and all these people like Clintons and Trumps and Bushes, what have you, and
yeah, this is not a Republican or Democratic issue. This is an across the board, you know, the powerful leaders
But nine eleven is the Achilles heel. 9/11 is something we cannot let go by and pretend that this is something we can't understand or it cannot be solved. It cannot be solved by people who don't want to solve it, but by people who really want to solve it, it can very easily be solved. And it would have been solved way back when, in 2001, had the media done any investigation on their own. But the media is complicit in the cover-up.
Totally. Does the arrest and subsequent death or ostensible death or whatever to call it of Jeffrey Epstein mean anything to you in this whole the history that you've looked at here, is it significant in terms of it being a turning point in the right direction somehow in all of this?
Well, yes, if it's investigated. I mean, because...
That's what remains to be seen,
It obviously involves...
But even if it's not investigated, the fact that he's gone down and his role in the whole thing,
his death could be part of the cover-up.
It doesn't mean much, but it has to be investigated because it's the network behind it that's important, not Jeffrey Epstein himself.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
Yeah.
So you're saying even if if the network behind him is not investigated, they can continue to operate even though he has gone down.
Right. That's right. That's right.
But I mean, in terms of like a turning of the tide, well, let me ask it more simply. You've been at this for how many years now? This subject, the crime.
Well, this 18 years.
Okay.
Ever since the beginning. This particular subject.
How would you describe where are we now on the map of this? Are we, or how do you feel personally? More hope? Are you hopeful? Are you are you close to a breakthrough? What can people who have been working on this and trying to get the truth about this, how we don't have a media, right? We have so much corruption. We have so, but what is the hope?
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of people that have done a lot of investigating, and a great deal has been discovered. Like we talked about the molten metal and the nanothermite, what have you, these discoveries that were not supposed to happen happened. So we know we've been lied to, and now we have this big problem, is that we have this 1,000-pound elephant in the front room. We have to figure out a way to get it out of the front room, and that, you know, we have corruption in the government at the highest level. We have, obviously, the people that carried out 9/11. In order to continue the deception, in order to continue their crime, which is the war on terror and everything that followed after 9/11, they have to maintain control of the U.S. government. Primarily, they have to maintain control of the presidency, the White House. And they've succeeded in doing that with George Bush and Obama and now Trump. But the thing is, what's happening is that the increasingly Zionist character of a U.S. president and government has gotten to be too much for everybody. And it's become very obvious, very flagrant, very illegal. You know, with Trump moving the embassy to Jerusalem and recognizing the occupation of the annexation of the Golan Heights, what have you. And,
well, the thing, you know, the now, other, what about not being able to boycott Israeli?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just crazy.
But at the same time, many Americans believe that Donald Trump is at war with what we call the deep state. And if this isn't deep state, what is?
Yeah, well, a lot of people want to believe that and think that, but when we look at his actions, you know, his actions are contrary to that.
I agree, but there's like an uprising, let's just say from the street level, from, you know, citizen media. There's something happening that we've never had before. I think the most important part of it is that the media, the Mockingbird media, is now totally exposed, and very few people believe just about anything they say. So I think that's the Achilles heel of the 9/11 truth finally breaking out.
Yes, but as you said, you know, you don't expect to read about 9/11 truth in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or hear about it at CNN or
but they're
Fox
seen
News.
As Pravda now.
So
nobody believes them anyway, so it's sort of decorative, you know.
Wait, because, by the way, Chris, have you been in touch with Meiswinkel and Harrison, the guys who did up that petition on...
I gave them some information, and they used some of my information in their presentation of evidence, the points that they gave for the grand jury. Yes, and I gave them some other information after that as well.
So
I'm in touch with them.
What do you think about their whole initiative? Do you think that has any promise, or do you think it's going to somehow be finessed out of effectiveness?
Well, it's a very worthwhile initiative, of course. I mean, has to be done. And I think that more lawsuits have to be brought, because litigation is our only hope, I mean, short of revolution. You have to sue these people left, right, and center. You have to sue them every which way. And maybe the grand jury will result in something. Maybe it will be shut down. I don't know. Because it's in the same U.S. District Court from the Southern District of New York where the 9/11 cases were all shut down in this what I call war of attrition against the relatives.
Right.
You know, they were all shut down in Larry or Alvin K. Hellerstein's courtroom there in Manhattan. And that's where this case is. And the case, you know, the people that are handling this grand jury are, you know, similar, you know, counterterrorism kind of people. I don't know what's going to happen. It's a secret process. But I hope that it works. And if it doesn't work, they should just have to keep crafting more and more lawsuits, because there are thousands of people in New York City who are very sick, and they're very sick because they inhaled this very toxic smoke that was heavily laden with nanoparticles, you know. And those people all have cases that they can be brought, you know, against the culprits of 9/11, because the smoke that rose from the World Trade Center was extremely toxic and has sickened and killed many, many thousands of people.
Are these mostly people who are right down there at Ground Zero, or is it other parts of the city as well? Yeah, so obviously,
well,
that would be the worst hit down there. But
all the first responders that worked on or near the pile were affected, and people who lived nearby the pile were affected. The smoke was very hot, and it was extremely hot, and it produced nanoparticles. And these nanoparticles were inhaled or ingested by firefighters, what have you, and it created these very very lethal forms of cancer that are quite unusual, because it causes the damage by infiltrating. Those nanoparticles get into the nucleus of the human cell. Wow. where they totally wreak havoc with the human system. So that's, but when you understand that nature of that smoke, you realize, wait, this is not a normal collapse of a building. This was something else. This was again the energy that created that created those molten pools of iron. This was something quite unusual. So when you ask those questions, then you get right back to the whole thing. What brought down the towers, where we started from?
Chris, I want to pull back. We only have a few minutes left. Just what once was called the 9/11 truth movement. I don't know if that's still what it's called. I understand that it's a big and fractious family. I come out of a family like that on a different subject. And I'm sure there's been a ton of infiltration, and I'm sure there are factions fighting about their different interpretations of 9/11. But how would you describe the whole? The climate and the feeling of the 9/11 truth movement right now, and maybe compare it a little bit to previous years.
Well, generally, it's the people who are truly concerned about what happened and what's happening to the country. There are, of course, people that are going to inside the movement who are going to try to infiltrate and mislead, you know, mm-hmm. and block. You know, I'm blocked. I'm not invited to most 9/11 groups because. You know, people that invite me or have me on their shows often have problems afterwards. They get a lot of criticism, and But in general, the process, the group, the movement is strong, and it's
international. That's for sure.
It's international, but it's still small compared to the overall public, because the overall public doesn't quite understand the importance of 9/11. And ending the war on terror.
Okay, a quick question. Quick mm-hmm. question. If you were a lawyer, who would be on your top 10 list to indict for this crime?
Well, it would be a lot of Israelis, Ehud Barak and Bibi Netanyahu. Then it would also be, of course, John Ashcroft would have to be involved, and Michael Chertoff at the Department of Justice, George Bush and Dick Cheney. And their assistants, Ari Fleischer. It requires these people have to be interrogated because they have committed crimes in connection to 9/11. Whether it was simply blocking an investigation, or in the case of the Bush Cheney, waging war, engaged in a conspiracy to wage a war of aggression, and to lie to the public. These are all crimes, and that's what we have to do: is that these people have to be prosecuted and interrogated to get to the bottom of the whole thing.
Well, I'll tell you, it certainly is the crime that keeps on giving. People are dying here. People are dying in these wars. The money, the treasure that has been bled out of this country. And
that's right.
And by the way, into the pockets of these people who were part of the original crime and now making money off of the wars.
Has anything about 9/11 come out in WikiLeaks? That's really significant?
Not much. No.
Hmm, interesting.
No.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait for that then, maybe.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean. Well, I hope that, that the...
What's the closest we're getting to cracking through?
The closest is my books, my Solving 9/11 books. I'm coming out with a new book September 11th this year called The Original Articles, Volume 2. And so I've been writing and investigating this crime for 18 years, and there's a lot of information in the Solving 9/11 books that identifies the network behind the crime. And that's what you have to understand. This is a very, very well-organized, very sophisticated crime run by a network of people with a lot of power.
What about the International Criminal Court, real quick?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's like the United States is not party to that in ICC, so they're blocked that way, too.
Chris, where can people find you? Real quick, we're closing out. We have a few seconds. Where can people find you?
Bolin.com, BOLLYN.com, or Facebook under Christopher Bolin.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much. All the best. Go forth and have no fear.